Welcome back, everyone, to Progressively Incorrect. My name is Zach Groeschel, and I am super excited today to be interviewing Sean Morrissey about his word mapping project, something I've been very excited to explore in more depth. I'm a huge fan of Sean's work. If you've ever seen him present, he's a dynamic presenter and just a super human teacher. But before we jump on over to Sean, I just wanted to talk about the Explicit Teaching Institute that is happening this summer. We're getting very close to that at the time of recording, and so you might not be able to get in. But just in general, I will be running these Explicit Teaching Institutes every summer in New York City, and I just want it to be a blast. I've put in a lot of work into trying to codify what it is to be a great teacher using this effective methodology of explicit and direct instruction. And we're going to have guest speakers, and you're in New York City. I mean, what? it's just awesome to be there. So check out the show notes for the Eventbrite and get yourself informed. And perhaps you can make it to this one or the next one. I'm so excited to promote that because it really is a labor of love. Sean, I am so happy to finally bring you on to Progressively Incorrect. How you doing, man?
I'm doing terrific. School year is almost over, so still got about two more weeks with the kids, though. We're pretty late up here in the Northeast.
We are too. We're in the same boat. But I was just in South Carolina and a bunch of other places, and they're out. They're all. It's the summer vacation. Tell me about yourself. What do you currently do?
So I teach fifth grade. I teach in a suburb of Buffalo, New York. So that's kind of my primary day job. I've been a teacher for, this is my 18th year teaching, 18th full year. Previous to that, I was a school psychologist and worked in that role for 8. I did a little research as well. I worked two jobs for a while early on. So I was lucky enough to work in the research community for about 5 years as well.
Let's jump ahead into that, because I'm curious if that time as a school psychologist and just exposure to research, if that shaped kind of how you think about student learning. Has that been something that's really impacted you and has influenced your teaching?
100%. So like even like in research back, I worked with kids with ADHD, and I did some alcoholism research as well. I was a research assistant. And we just like with treatments, they always talk back then like empirically validated treatments. So treatments that had the best bets, like that were most likely to work. So that was like always like ingrained into me. And then, as a psych, even in grad school, we had a consultation class, and I still remember it. They would teach us not to use the word research when talking with teachers because it would like turn them off. And the consultation teacher, he was 100% right. Like when I first started, and I would say, well, the research kind of says this. Teachers, I think it's changed a little bit now for sure, but teachers did not want to hear that. They're like, oh, yeah. Some people say research on this side, and some people say the opposite. And then I'm trying to explain, well, like we have 99 researchers saying, this is supportive, with maybe one like, out there that says something different. So for sure that has kind of been kind of a part of me for, throughout my whole professional career. Yeah.
It seems like anyone that's kind of touched on psychology, like, I guess, appreciates a little bit that you sort of need to measure stuff. Like you need to like see if it's working, and maybe those measures are imperfect, but you sort of can't rely on hopes and dreams, right? You can't just describe in vague terms whether or not learning has happened without some sort of evidence, I wonder, has that sort of translated into your obsession with explicit instruction and with vocabulary building?
Yeah, I think for sure. Like I've always been kind of like a data geek, like, oh, we have to measure this. So I'm constantly measuring, with my students, what's working or what's not. I think you first take like what's the best bets out there. You align what the research says. You teach it in kind of your way, what the research says, not your way, but like, in kind of best practice. And then you need to measure, are your kids actually learning? because if they're not, then you definitely have to change it up. Like, what's the sense of just spending all this time and kids aren't actually learning? Which, when you bring up explicit instruction, the more you explicitly use explicit instruction in general, the quicker kids learn. And that holds true with vocabulary as well. I mean, vocabulary is really, really broad, but a main part of teaching vocabulary is explicitly teaching students words. You don't want to have them mess around for 20 minutes just trying to figure words out. I think Craig Barton, like he always said, play guess what's in my head. I've seen it, like I've observed it as a psychologist going into classrooms, and even I probably have done it a little bit in my like in the past too, where you get to a word and you stop and you're like, oh, okay, what does the word passionate mean? And then you're asking Johnny, and Johnny gave you something totally wrong, and then you're like, nope. And then you ask Mary, and Mary gets it totally wrong, and you're like, nope. And you go through four kids, and then they just gave all the wrong answers, so kids are hearing all the wrong things, and then you're like, no, this is what it means. So now I kind of tend to start off with, well, the word passionate means this, and let's get to the chase.
It is weird. Like, I think even if the student in that case responded with the correct definition, there's so many things that are wrong already with the setup. It's like, number one, kids are not very good at projecting their voice. I mean, that might seem pretty low level, but like the definition could have come from the teacher who the person who's facing the room, and instead it's the kid in the front who's facing the wall, and no one can really hear them. And then on top of that, kids are really bad at giving like very minimalist type of like easy child-friendly definition themselves. They add in lots of extra words. So they give this kind of rambling definition, even if it's correct. But they could give a misconception. They could give the incorrect definition, and the teacher goes, in my experience, like, ah, oh, like yeah, sort of. I get, yeah, that's kind of right. Like, oh, well, how about this? And now we've got two competing definitions. What's right? And I want to talk about your approach to vocabulary. You've seemed to operationalize it in a way that it's really getting a lot of people excited online. And it's called the Word Mapping Project. Now, tell me a little bit about the Word Mapping Project, how it came to be. What made you think like there has to be a better way to teach to teach words?
I think the research for vocabulary, there's just some amazing researchers, Isabel Beck, Margaret McCowan, out of Pittsburgh. You have like they're kind of two of my go-tos, but you have all these researchers out there. They have kind of researched it. They're telling you what is sort of best practice, but then trying to take it and put it all together, because I think still vocabulary is kind of segmented. Like, oh, we can teach these words here. Morphology sort of put in a different area. Spelling always plays a role in that, and sort of spelling sometimes is it's like on its own island. So I would say I've always been big in teaching vocabulary since like day one. That was actually my observation to get at my teaching job was a vocab lesson. So I've always been big into it, but trying to now like what's out there, and nothing that was out there kind of what was good enough for what like I wanted to use. So honestly, I was like taking the research and kind of starting writing sort of my own curriculum over the years. And then I kind of found like, oh, I started kind of layering things. Like years ago, I realized like explicit instruction, teaching words in pairs seemed to really, really work. So, the research, like Anita Archer is awesome. She has like kind of her vocabulary setup where, when you introduce the word, you're always having kids chorally say the word back for pronunciation, right? So like that's a part. So that's the first thing that we do. So if I'm saying, the word that we're going to learn next is nature, kids are then responding, what's the word nature? Pronouncing words first and then explicitly teaching words in pairs, I just found to be really, really just it seems to really work. The data kind of bore out in my classroom, like teaching passionate and dispassionate together. It doesn't take that much longer to teach both words, than just to teach one separately, or like optional and mandatory. So teaching those words in pairs. So what's nice about teaching words in pairs is then right away you can differentiate. You could actually give a kids an example, and on their mini whiteboards, they're either writing down optional or mandatory based on the example that you gave. So they're actually spelling as well. So like hitting them like with that layer, hitting them with the spelling layer, and then like hitting students with the morphology layer too, but like keeping those words and like all the words are like an anchor. Like if I'm teaching segregation and congregation, so kids learn those words in pairs. The next day, then they're going to learn that GREG, the base, and congregate or segregate means flock or gather. So you're going to put that layer on top of it. So it just layer upon layer. And I think it's kind of has a synergistic effect. Kids learn more that way.
I'm curious about that word pairing aspect. Like I think you're right. I think you're onto something that it doesn't take that much longer. It does take a little bit longer, right? Than if you just if it like you said, passionate and dispassionate. Like I could say this is passionate, this is not passionate, and I sort of like kind of avoid saying the word dispassionate. How do you introduce the sort of the other word pair when they don't know either of them while kind of avoiding, the risk is, of course, they don't know either word, so they don't really, it doesn't really help them, sort of thing.
So it's like, it's explicit instruction. So I'm like right away saying like, okay, the next word we're learning is segregation. What's the word? They're saying segregation. I generally will put that word in syllables as well, and I may put it into its morphological parts, its morphemes, like its meaningful parts, I may break the word into as well. But then I'm giving just a quick, nice student-friendly definition so the kids hear a nice, concise, like you said, not rambling, less words is better in this case because it's their first exposure to the word. And then right away, I'm giving them two examples, quick examples on what is segregation, And then right away, under the document camera, I'm giving them the word congregation, and I'm explicitly teaching the word congregation in a nice student-friendly definition too. So right away, it's explicit instruction of those word pairs. So they know what it is. They know what segregation is. They know what congregation is. And then they're practicing right away, trying to differentiate between the two. They have their mini whiteboards out. I'm giving them like an example. The people came together to sing and pray. Okay, is it segregation or congregation? And the kids are writing on their mini whiteboards either segregation or congregation. So not only are they differentiating the meaning, they're also spelling, which spelling helps map words into long-term memory better as well.
What I'm hearing too is like you get kids into practice as early as possible. That I think that's super important. Like the child-friendly definition allows it to be, not this abstract thing, but then like a lot of times what we end up doing is we don't get them into the word, right? And so you do that kind of discrimination practice where you're like immediately, is it this or is it that? And it's like, well, I can't even do that unless I had paid attention. And so I really got to focus on what those two things are. I think that's fantastic. There's a few other things you mentioned there too, which is like that you get the kids to pronounce the word. You get them to say it. I'm assuming it's choral response or whatever. Like what does that do? I often see that teachers are getting the kids to fill out Frayer models, and I kind of sense that the kids haven't even said the word and something's off. You know what I mean?
Interesting. Like I love people know I love teaching vocabulary. I don't think now this might shock people. I don't think I've ever quite used the Frayer model like it was like I've never really used it. I mean, I've used aspects of it, but like on a piece of paper where teachers like, hey, this is the model. I've never used that on a piece of paper before. So it's just getting kids into practice, and it's 100% like participation. So like I don't have kids just like looking and staring off the space. They're practicing what is the word, what isn't, and they're spelling, and it has to be 100% participation because they're showing me their boards. If they're not, they're actively refusing to do it, which I never really have. So, right.
So you're using like universal response systems.
Yeah.
Let's get everybody going. You got this document camera that's like, the sort of visual, the pairing of what they're doing. Let me ask a few questions people might have about the word mapping project. Maybe the first one that I get constantly would be about vocabulary instruction is how many words can you realistically expect kids to learn? Like they're just too many words. That's sort of the fear. And I know that looking at your work, you're quite a bit more ambitious maybe than we typically are, or with what many like sort of box curriculum are. So tell me about that.
Yeah, I'm a whole lot more ambitious. I've seen in my classroom where if we just have to have the structures and framework in place, and kids can learn a whole lot. So let me like I'm going to go through like an example of like how many words in a unit, and a unit's about maybe 9 or 10 days of instruction. Okay, so here is one unit. I'm just going to go through a list of words in pairs. So these are just the words in pairs. We got regression and progression. You have passionate, dispassionate, segregation, congregation, trepidation, confidence, insubordination, compliance, nation, disunion, procrastination, initiation, optional, mandatory. So those are 18 words just in pairs. But then students also learn the bases PASS, which means suffer or endure. So I'm from Buffalo. They call us like the most passionate football fans out there. And most people don't realize, well, that base comes from suffer or endure. So there it is, right? But then kids are learning under that base: passionate, dispassionate, compassion, impassive, passionless, passive. They're learning GREG for congregation, segregation. They're also learning aggregate, gregarious, desegregation, egregious. So these are definitely words that I don't think in elementary that kids are typically exposed to, and they can learn they can learn those words. Here's some other words in the unit. Under another base in the unit, it's NATE meaning born, like nation, native, cognate, international, prenatal, postnatal, innate. So just in like the primary curriculum, you're learning about 40 words over the course of like 9 days. And then you're trying to get kids. So like I have some extended materials too, where like most of my class uses, where like when you learn like regression and progression, it's like moving forward or backwards. That's kind of like the category. They're learning words like this: relapse, deterioration, degeneration, reversion. Moving forward, they're learning development, advancement, evolution, and expansion. So altogether, kids, we're talking about, maybe 80 words in a unit if you're pushing some of your more advanced kids, or maybe your top half the class with the extension materials. But all kids are exposed to about 40 words in a unit.
That is certainly a lot more. And I think that requires a refocusing around vocabulary. I guess my question would be like, why not focus on something else? Like for you, what does vocabulary do or enable that other choices in the ELA curriculum can't quite do?
I think when you talk about like knowledge building, I think like learning language and vocabulary is part of knowledge building. Like it's like one of the main aspects. Like you have content and then you have words, and a lot of times they obviously overlap, but it's just knowledge building. And Sold a Story came out like years ago, right? And to talk about like how we've kind of messed up not teaching phonics, I think our country is actually, with balanced literacy, has done a worse job with teaching vocab and language. And still, people aren't talking enough about it. Like kids, we talk about kids like decoding words, like the word omit, OMIT, or omitted. All right. So if kids can sort of try to pronounce that word like omitted or omitted, well, how are they going to get the pronunciation right if they never heard that word? So kids need to be exposed. And language helps with decoding. Of course, if you can fluently read, it helps build your language easier as well, but they are reciprocal. And like language, I don't know, language, most, the biggest variance of like reading comprehension is vocab. Like, if you put it like a regression analysis, vocab usually comes up number one tied to if kids are going to understand, what they're reading.
And I think a lot of like my interpretation of how your program works, like looking into the materials and looking at your tweets and so on, is you actually save quite a bit of time by your approach to like integration. Like it's not that
Yeah.
you have this parallel spelling track, this parallel comprehension track, parallel fluency track, and everything is sort of siloed in the sense of like I kind of have to use. I have separate approach with separate words. These are all words. So there's this artistry, I guess, of weaving together these words into a coherent, integrated package. Maybe you can talk to
Yeah.
us about it. It's kind of hard to picture unless you've done it before.
Yeah. So like when I started writing this, I started with sound. So I was trained so speech to print where, there's different spelling patterns that, you could use for a sound. Okay. Like let's take, for example, like the ol sound. Like it could be spelled EL, AL, IL, right? And so I first took words because I'm teaching spelling patterns for sounds. So I took really nice, important words that upper elementary kids, middle school kids should know. And I basically tied them into a spelling pattern. Like in the like E, like words that have the EL spelling pattern, like words I picked were counsel, libel, and belligerent. So I picked those words to focus on the spelling pattern. What I then did is I took those words and I found a nice antonym so I could teach those words in pairs. So if I taught libel, then I taught complement. So then there's the word pairs there. So we have working on decoding and spelling patterns and then working on just what words mean. And then what I did is I took some of those words and we're learning the bases, kind of the roots of those words. Like the word belligerent, we're going to learn BELL means war or fighting. So all of it kind of revolves around like the word. And what's nice is I think in a lot of times kids don't love like specific spelling practice because they think it's boring. The words are usually words they know, but they're like, my kids have never complained about like spelling because the spelling's just embedded and learning the words, and we're learning really cool hard words, so the kids don't complain. They're motivated to do the spelling work.
That's awesome. I mean, I guess one of my I'm just curious how you ensure that these things get reviewed properly
Yeah.
because you can introduce a spelling set of 8 or 12 words. You can get to the 40, but then you just kind of move on. Like the kids experience that constant, like that Sisyphean kind of the boulder goes up to the top of the mountain, it rolls back down, and there's new words and new
Yeah.
words. And how do
Yeah.
you, what's your approach to review when it comes to this?
Yeah. So, like, I mean, the research on vocab is pretty clear where kids need a certain amount of exposures in different contexts of words to really map them in long-term memory. So you're talking like, and kids do learn at different rates. We like it that we need to be aware of that. Some kids can pick it up after four exposures, some kids may need a dozen. But in the word mapping project curriculum, for the primary like 40 words in that unit, there's usually between 10 and 12 different exposures in different contexts. Many of the times you're spelling them out that kids are being exposed to. So, like one way to expose kids is fluency. So, like fluency passages. So they're reading those words, pronouncing those words correctly in a fluency passage, and they're seeing those words in context in a passage. So they're answering questions based on the passage, but they're also rereading that passage with partners. So, it's not a separate reading fluency like lesson. It's part of the actual vocab curriculum. Like, I don't think we should ever do any fluency passages now that are separate. It should be either tied to words or science and social content. And only that only makes sense because then like it's a better use of the time. We only have so much time. So that's one way that the kids are getting exposed. So other ways is through morphology. and through working with morphology matrices. So it's hard to just talk about them, but if you have the matrix like GREG meaning flock, so that's kind of your base in the middle of a matrix, then you're tying prefixes and suffixes to that base. So like if you have GREG Greg, you can do like congregate, segregate. So then the kids are learning like the word parts, and that's just another exposure in a different way to the language. Tons of retrieval practice activities and independent booklets where independently the kids are answering lots of different questions or using the words in writing. So that's just kind of interleaved throughout. So the kids are getting enough practice, even just like asking kids questions. So like, say I taught segregation, congregation, trepidation in subsequent days, I'll just even ask the kids quick questions for like quick turn and talks, like, ooh, with trepidation, she stepped onto the stage and looked out at the crowd. What might have she been feeling at the moment? So I'm not asking the kids like as a like definition. I'm asking them to apply what that is and ooh, how is she feeling? They need to know what trepidation means. So that's like a language retrieval practice activity that that's part of the curriculum.
It just sounds excellent. I have so many questions for you. One of them is like, how do you avoid this kind of splintered or sort of, yeah, the splintered approach to your curriculum where I can totally imagine someone hears this and goes, okay, I'm gonna really have a great vocab section or block. Maybe I do it on Mondays or maybe I do it every day for 10 minutes. But then how, you know, that could get in the way of reading rich texts, of learning about how the world, you know, how the world works, about some of the background knowledge or knowledge-rich kind of components. So how do you make sure this feeds into this system that is going to allow them to really like learn about the world around them and be able to use those words?
I think with like language and content like overlap. So, we read two, okay, so we read this year we read One Crazy Summer and the Watsons Go to Birmingham. So it's two novels, really good novels we did units with, and it's during the civil rights era. And learning words like segregation and learning words, it helps, I think. When you get to the content, you learn the content quicker, and vice versa. If you're learning content and you have an idea of things, it helps you learn words quicker as well. So there is a reciprocal relationship. But even like kids like applying it, like in the book, we learn the word nation, and it's the base Nate being born. Well, in One Crazy Summer, the author, the one of the characters wrote about the birth of a nation, and my kids right away kind of linked why, like that, how, like why that poem was so important in the context in that novel, because they learned the word nation just before that in the curriculum.
Fantastic. Well, can you tell us a little bit about the structure of like a daily ELA block or a lesson using the curriculum that you've developed? Like, I'm sure people are gonna like, what do I get and what do I see and how do I follow this in kind of a very practical way? I do want to know more about that.
Yeah, it is definitely a very structured curriculum, because you can't, as a teacher, come up with like vocab examples on the fly. Like I feel pretty good. Like I've worked hard at this for like 20 years, and I can't do it off the fly. So pretty simply, it's a simple four-part lesson plan. First part is all like retrieval practice, where they were quick questions focused on prefixes, suffixes, and previous words and roots that we've learned in previously. So it's, just like when I said the word trepidation, that would be a retrieval practice in part one. Spelling dictation is also retrieval practice. The research is clear. Just having quizzing kids every day on in spelling and trying to spell words correctly and getting feedback right away, it works. So spelling bit dictation is in there as retrieval practice. Questioning the kids on the words and questioning kids on the word parts, prefixes, suffixes, and bases. So that's the first part of the lesson. And that goes through quick, because it's quick retrieval practice. The second part of the lesson, it flip-flops every day. It's either explicit instruction of three word pairs, so six words on a day. And it's like teachers say, oh, that's a lot, but you can do that in 12 minutes. So, and there's a lot of practice. So explicit instruction of six new words is like the second part of the lesson, or the morphology matrix, and those flip every other day. Third part of the lesson is always a fluency activity, where those words that kids previously learned are embedded in a fluency passage, so they're reading those words correctly in context. And the fourth part is they have their student booklets, and this is, I probably have made, oof, I think in the whole curriculum there's almost 10,000 pages total of across the three different levels. So the kids get a lot of practice in different contexts by themselves, that they work independently. So that's kind of the lesson plan in four parts. It's pretty structured though. Like teachers, even like the matrices, I have like all of the answers all there. So teachers aren't trying to figure it all out on themselves, because it's just too hard.
It seems like we've moved away from sort of the intellectual focus on the beauty of words, on the use of words. And one thing that I noticed from you is you exude this just sort of this interest in words. Was that something that you always had? Were you good at words, and that's why you got into this, or?
I was not good at words. So I grew up in a little city outside of Buffalo, but definitely I struggled to get, I think the SAT was popular back when, I struggled to get a 500 on the ELA, on the English portion of the SAT. Like I did not have a great lex, like I didn't know a lot of words. I did reasonably okay in school, but language was not a strength. So that was definitely not, never a strength, which is kind of interesting now that, like, the more I teach and the more I see like the value in it, I just get motivated more and more every year.
I mean, do you need to be a linguist to understand this program? Like, do you need to know what all the word parts are and how to sentence diagram and all this stuff? I didn't get any grammar lessons or any of those kind of old school conventions. Like, what do you need to know to be able to use this program?
So that's what's interesting. I think one thing that I did right and like the right way in this is teachers are going to learn right along with the students. Like I have a PD, like I have about a 10 to 15 hour asynchronous PD that, teachers, if a teacher's just going to do it themselves, they have a nice PD where they're learning all the morphology, through the professional development and even through the lessons. Like if I'm teaching a certain route, like in the teacher lesson plan, they're learning along as well, because you have to scale that up. Like there's so many words, there's so many routes, you have to give teachers access to it. You can't expect them to learn it themselves. It's too hard.
Absolutely. And I feel that. I feel that when I was in the middle of my classroom and I was like, I've got to give a non-example, and I just can't come up with it. I just can't come up with it, and so I don't, or I don't give any examples, and I'm sitting here just kind of freelancing, and the kids don't get that clarity that I learned later from other like really structured programs is just necessary to teach all kids a load of words. So at the end of every semester or testing period, you like to kind of talk about the results that your kids get. And I wonder about those results because you're in the classroom, you're working as a teacher, and you're spending all your evenings and weekends, I'm sure, like with this word mapping project. How does it turn out in terms of the on the ground results in your classroom?
So like I've noticed, like from years ago, like I'm starting to get pretty good outcomes, even in things that aren't like just vocabulary, like in reading comprehension. I'm usually like, state testing. I don't work at a needy school, and I tell people that, like, for sure. But at my school, there's plenty of more affluent schools, and in Buffalo, we're not the most affluent like city, right? So, but results that I'm getting on state tests are significantly better than the most affluent schools. Like last year, 90% of my students on a really hard science test reached proficiency, when the next school after, the next district after, was 67%. And I attribute I'm a big content guy too. I like teaching a lot of content, but I attribute it to a lot of it to language. Like I taught a lot of words. You know, the kids weren't scared of the words on the science test because it's super dense with academic vocabulary, like words like function, feature. They didn't get overwhelmed. And I think my kids just did well that did well. Now I have to bring up too, like, you know, can this work in needy schools too? And I'll give example. I'm sure he'll be okay with it. So Joe Finch is a fifth grade teacher in California, and he works definitely in his needy school. He's teaching a lot of words. So he piloted the word mapping curriculum this year. His school on their science test, fifth grade, their usual proficiency rate's usually like 12%. Last year, he mentioned like, you know, he had maybe one, maybe two students to pass. This year, he was almost to 50%. He was like 46%. So, and like his district's at like 12, and he's at almost 50% because he's setting the bar high. He's like, well, I don't know. These kids can do it. And he's using really good curriculum now, like not just mine, but he's using a lot of novel studies. But man, he's ramping up. And it's not just my classroom anymore. We're seeing it in other classrooms. Spelling for sure is where you see it the most. So my kids took a standardized spelling test this year at the start. The average score is a 51st percentile. So Joe average class in spelling. I moved the whole class up to the 76th percentile. So, and like researchers will know, like that is huge different. You know, I one student moved from the fifth percentile on a standardized spelling test to the 58th. So doing better than 5 out of 100 kids, now doing better than 58. And I didn't even teach those words to the kids. It was like it was standardized. It's not words, you know, that were just taught from my curriculum. So it's kind of like those are life altering in 1 year. You're moving from the 27th percentile in spelling to the 73rd. Like you are getting it. So like is that sticking? Well, it seems to be.
Yeah, and it seems to be the solution that or part of the solution that many people are looking for because they know about phonics and they don't teach the early phonics sequence that occurs in kindergarten through second grade.
Yeah.
They're in the upper grades like you are, and they just like, how do I translate the science of reading into upper elementary explicit structured teaching?
Yeah.
It's fantastic. I think people should go check it out. I will put a bunch of links in that you'll provide me into the show notes for people to go check it out. And I hear you're starting up some. You have the possibility of supporting schools and so on. How do people get in contact with you and make sure that they can like
Yeah.
benefit from all the things you're providing?
Yeah, so individual teachers, schools can reach out. I have links at the wordmappingproject.com where you just reach out to get more information. I'm starting to do professional development this summer as well. So for sure in the summer, I'm still this is a it's a heavy lift for me. I'm still a full-time classroom teacher. So I'm doing both at the moment, but probably down the road, you know, I'm over 50 now. At some point, I'll probably retire from the classroom and I'll have more time to go out to districts. But right now I do have time in the summer to go out in districts to support teachers. In the curriculum too, though, there is a nice asynchronous like I said earlier, so teachers can get that as well, because this is something that you have to ramp up your learning as well. You know, you if you don't, you're it, it's it, you know, kids are still going to struggle. So, yeah.
It's awesome. Sean, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This is one of those, it was like, you should have come on a lot earlier, is one of those things where we just finally the stars aligned and you got to come on Progressively Incorrect. But certainly the tone and the themes of this podcast speak a lot to the work you do. And I'm just so impressed with what you're able to accomplish. Listeners, thank you so much for coming on, and tuning in to Progressively Incorrect. We are towards the end of this season, and regardless of when you listen to this, I just really appreciate your support and your enthusiasm for this podcast. spread it around, give it a 5-star rating, do that whole thing where you send it around, and that's basically the best form of advertising I can possibly rely on. Sean, thank you so much for coming on, man. Take care.
All right. I appreciate it. All right. Thanks, Zach.